Hello, and I want to welcome everyone to the Community Engagement, New Approaches and Success Stories Internet Web Seminar Series, sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program. This is the second session entitled Community Engagement Activities for Safe Drinking Water. I'm Carol Braverman. I'm with EPA Region 5 in Chicago, and I'll be the moderator for today's session. We're going to get started in a few minutes, but while we're waiting for other folks, I'd like to cover some housekeeping items. When you registered, you were directed to this seminar's URL, and that is the front page for today's seminar. The front page contains a short abstract of today's session, short bio sketches of the presenters, and we also have hot links to the presenters' email addresses in the event that you have questions after today's presentation. For those of you joining us on the phone lines, your phones were placed on mute when you joined the call. We will be having a question and answer session for each speaker after the presentation. We ask that you stay on mute during the presentation, during the question and answer session, unless you are asking a question. To unmute your phone during the question and answer session, you'll need to press *7. And after that, you will need to put yourself back on mute by pressing *6. Again, to mute, *6. To unmute in order to ask a question, *7. We expect a lot of folks on the line, and that will really help us keep the quality of the audio transmission high. And I also want to say, please don't place this on hold, because we would get music that way. For those of you who are participating on the phone lines, go to the presentation now, which is entitled Community Engagement Activities for Safe Drinking Water. For those on the Internet connecting through the URL, you should click on Go to Session icon near the bottom of the page, and you will be on slide one of the presentation. Going to slide two of the presentation, you'll find the instructions about how to use the navigation icons. In order to advance the slides, you click on the single right arrow at the top of the slide or by clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. You will see a question mark at the top. This is if you need to contact us either for technical difficulties, please click on the question icon to let us know and include a phone number, and we'll help you troubleshoot it. And this is how we'd also like Internet participants to ask questions. And Internet participants, we encourage you to ask the questions during the presentation using the question icon. Submit them in advance. Phone participants will let you know when it's time. At the end of the presentation, we'll walk you through our links page where you will find resources for today's topic. Associated with the links, we do also have an online feedback form. Please consider filling it out. We do look at these comments. It helps us to improve the content and delivery mechanisms, and this link will be up indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentations. These seminars are placed in an archive with a soundtrack, so in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. Past seminars are available on the CLUIN website and also accessible by iTunes by searching for the Superfund Research Program, which will take you to the Hazardous Waste Cleanup Information CLUIN Archives and the new Superfund Research Program Research Brief podcast. With that, we are ready to start this session. Once more, I would like to remind phone participants to keep your phones on mute. And again, please do not put us on hold. Please go to slide number 3. Our first speaker today is Lori Reardon. Ms. Reardon has been working in environmental communications field for over 17 years. She was an environmental studies major at Connecticut College and received her MES from Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies with a concentration in environmental communications. During her tenure at the Connecticut Department of Environmental Protection's Office of Long Island Sound Programs as public coordinator, she developed a keen understanding of the need to create two-way dialogue between researchers and end users to ensure that research questions and results are used to benefit public health and the environment. She is particularly interested in combining modern and traditional research translation methods to help communities understand environmental priorities and consequences. Ms. Reardon received the 2008 Eco Award from Global Environmental Communications, LLC, for Kearsarge Magazine feature article, More Green on the Map, and she is also apparently the author of a children's book. Her presentation is entitled Face-to-Face Communication Empowers Communities to Spread the Word. That, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Raritan.
Hi, thank you so much, Carol and Justin and all the folks who have helped make this webinar series possible. I think it's a great idea that we have taken what began as a session at CTAC last November and turned it into this webinar series, and I hope that the CTAC session idea can continue. I know when we presented it there, a few folks were very excited to have community engagement and outreach kinds of talks going on, and so I hope that will become a tradition. And I also am glad that we have this webinar series, and I want to encourage everyone to participate in the rest of the series if you have the time, because I think all of these webinars will really be worth your while. There's a lot of good information. So I am going to tell you about the success that we've had with a movie we finished in November of 2009, In Small Doses, Arsenic. And it's really been an exciting process to see how much we've learned and how much the movie has been getting out and about. So one of the things that I would like to do is thank Tom Hampton, who is a part of our program who had the vision for the movie, and Bruce Stanton, our Superfund Research Program director, who paved the way to make it happen. And Bob Drake, who produced the film, has incredible talent. And Nancy Sorrell and the stakeholders that she has been working with for quite a number of years as PI, when she was PI of our Research Translation Corps and Outreach Corps, they really brought a huge amount of depth to the film. And so I will now advance to slide 4 and start with some basics. Certainly, when you think about communication, we made a movie and we started our process thinking about distribution somewhat, but the distribution end of things kind of happened more as we finished up the film. And one of the things that I'll be focusing on today is how we have discovered that actually face-to-face communication, showing the movie at conferences, getting it out and about, has really been the most effective way to get it out and around and into the folks who really need to hear about it. So, but starting with basics, face-to-face communication is really important. It's a way of communicating. It's a way that we've communicated since the beginning of time, and certainly it allows a feedback mechanism, which some other kinds of communication don't allow in the same way. You have the body language, you have the eye messaging, and I think that's important. And what you also have is the ability, especially in groups, to empower one another, especially if you're working around a common goal. So this is a theme that's being developed in the Superfund Research Program, certainly now with the focus on community engagement. And I threw this slide up here because I felt it was important. Community engagement is now a requirement of the Superfund Research Program. I think that's really important. And it's being defined as bidirectional interaction between community stakeholders and the research center. We at Dartmouth have always considered bidirectional communication an essential part of our research translation and outreach activities, and I'm really excited that this is being so highly emphasized. But what is our current reality in today's time? We are all addicted to the screen, whether we like it or not. So in today's age of multimedia, rapid-fire advances in technology, our huge social media onslaught, it's getting the word out is a form of communication, but it's also potentially very isolating. So we have this romance, this addiction to screen time. Here's some statistics.
Lori, I'm getting people who are asking you to speak louder.
Oh, speak louder.
Speak louder.
Okay.
A lot louder.
Oh, dear. Okay, and I'm also not advancing, telling you when I'm advancing the slides, so my apologies. If you're lost, I'm on slide 9, and I'm trying to speak more loudly. So I'm talking about face-to-face communication versus screen time, and here are some statistics that you probably already know, but television and internet are primary sources for Americans for gaining information on science and technology. The internet is the primary source of information for learning about specific issues, and more Americans select TV as their primary source of science and technology information than any other medium. How's that volume? Is that any better?
I'll find out in a minute.
Okay, great.
Stay loud.
Okay, so basically we decided to just go with the screen approach. We thought, well, we need to get a message out. We're going to go along with what we're learning in today's society and make a movie. So we made a short 10-minute movie in small doses arsenic. It's 10 minutes, which we think is about the length of focus time for most people, some people less, some people maybe a little more. But from our research and evaluation thus far, we seem to have people hanging in there and watching the whole thing. Our community, our audience, our target audience, private well owners in New England, and our message, test your well. Protect your family and test your well. So we have a sort of a tiered approach to our distribution of the movie. Since it was completed in November 2009, we've shown it at several big conferences, including the Superfund Research Program annual meeting, the New England Well Water Symposium. We got a lot of great feedback. That was very early on. And then it occurred to me it might be good to kind of have an event, have a screening. We have a movie, so let's have a screening. That's what we do. So we threw ourselves a party in Concord, which is our state capital. We invited all the people who were in the movie, all the stakeholders who helped us with the movie, local legislators, the press, and we had well drillers, we had remediation companies, and we also had the Concord Monitor show up, which is our local newspaper. Everyone was very excited. We watched the movie, then we had a nice reception, and people talked about how could we get the movie out. They came up with new ideas for us. We got new connections. Lots of networking occurred. Collaborations on research occurred, and we wound up with a front page story above the fold in the Concord Monitor about the movie and about the need to test wells for arsenic. So that was a really exciting outcome. And also, I meant to mention that at the same time, we did have some local legislators come to that premiere. They were in the middle of having a bill go through the New Hampshire House, which was proposing that arsenic in private well testing be required as part of any home sale contract. That proposal wound up dying in committee, but it did have ramifications in that it opened up a dialogue with the Department of Environmental Services and legislators and the New Hampshire Realtors Association, and they're now working on putting language into contract and sales agreements that will help with that testing possible requirement or consideration.
Lori, so, can you remind us what slide you're on?
Oh, sorry. I'm on 13. I'll try and get better about that. So, as I said, we presented the movie, showed it at various conferences, and this is a sampling of some of them. We found that by doing this, people were very excited to talk with me afterwards and get copies of the film. They had ideas for showing it in their own communities, on their cable access channels, in their conservation commission, to their local town council. They thought about having a local ordinance passed to require well testing. The New Hampshire Health Officers Association, I showed it at their annual meeting, and they're a great conduit. There's a health officer in almost every New Hampshire town, and that was a very successful way of getting the movie out. I asked them whenever I gave a copy of the movie out to be sure to tell me where it was used, how many people saw it, so that I could use that as part of my evaluation. I'm now moving on to slide 14. Our third tier of distribution, which is happening simultaneously with the other techniques, is the website links to the film. We have a vanity URL, www.insmalldoses.org, that takes you directly to the movie page that is a part of our Toxic Metals website. We also have asked all of our stakeholders to include links on their websites to the film. We have a Wikipedia link on a Wikipedia arsenic page that Tom Hampton put in for us, and other related organizations have included links on their websites. YouTube, the ubiquitous YouTube. We have over 1,100 hits, which for us seems like a lot. It's nothing compared to what Lady Gaga gets, of course, but it's all relative. That's another cheap, easy way to get movies out. So in terms of evaluation, we certainly know that the PEPH metrics manual will provide a lot of good options for ways to evaluate projects, and the movie, I believe, is being included as an example in that manual. We found that one-on-one conversation, as I mentioned, has been really effective. People are networking, they're brainstorming, they're telling us ideas, and then they're taking the movie and their own ideas and going out and moving that distribution process forward. We have a SurveyMonkey survey attached to the film on the website, and it's not a huge number of folks who've completed it, but it's over 100, and that has provided us with quite a bit of valuable information. Google Analytics is also a great way. We can see how many hits we get to the website movie page.
And you're on slide 16?
I'm sorry, yes.
Okay.
And as I mentioned, the trickle effect of the media news stories has also been really beneficial. Parents Magazine approached our director, Bruce Stanton, to interview him for a piece on children's health and toxic effects of metals. So that's been something that we didn't expect. I'm moving forward now to slide 17. Again, from the SurveyMonkey information, we have the ability to track the responses to our questions. The survey is 10 questions in total. So this one gives you an indication that we had 90% approximately tell us that they did receive the message from the movie that arsenic is harmful to human health. And then after watching the movie, we had 73% of those who have private wells agree that they were planning to have their well water tested. I'm on slide 19 now, sorry. So selected comments from SurveyMonkey again, just some that I thought were really interesting, that someone in Lotistock, formerly Reichenstein, very high levels of arsenic, can use the movie as a tool. I haven't heard whether it actually was translated, but certainly that's another outcome, that the movie is being used as a resource. Other people are using it to their benefit and educating their communities. People who have health issues, severe at times, can use it as additional information and get they're well treated. Also, people, it's helping them learn to ask questions. And here's someone on slide 20 who has rents and is wondering, hoping and wanting to push forward a requirement that landlords should test their apartment well waters. So that's exciting that it's helping in that regard. I'm now on slide 21. A comment showing that there is confusion out there regarding what is considered safe. 10 is the federal drinking water standard for public water supplies in terms of arsenic. The movie doesn't go into exact details about what is and what isn't a safe level. So we're glad to have these questions raised because there is still more conversation, more work needed. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. And certainly other people, as these last two comments indicate, are using it as a tool, as a model. So we're very excited about that. Again, on slide 22, other ways that the movie is getting out into the community. Larry Spencer is going to look at it as in his own community, setting up regulations for homeowners to test arsenic and get it onto their local cable channel. One of our research fellows showed it to students at Mount Desert Island Biological Lab, and then all the students were very excited to go test their own homes. One of our NGOs hopes to show it at a realtor training workshop, which would really be helpful. And the list kind of goes on. I'm now on slide 24. But you can see that it is really getting out there, and Columbia's Superfund Research Program is planning to use it as a model for some films that they hope to do with some local well owner communities with well water in New Jersey. So we're very happy to be able to have the film be used in this way. And again, we've had other exposure through WGBH TV. We had a webinar a few weeks back regarding Teachers Domain, which is a curriculum resource, a resource for teachers providing videos that they can use in their curriculum. So the movie will be a part of this environmental public health series. Should be up very soon. And investigator-initiated research translation, our director, Bruce Stanton, gave a great seminar in conjunction with the Mount Desert Island Biological Lab recently. And a lot of folks after that were very excited. And again, this whole idea of coming together face-to-face around a common goal, people have all these ideas. And so more people were coming up with other opportunities and ways to get the movie out. As a follow-up to the Red River Theater event that we had, where we brought everyone together to view the movie, this past February we sort of officially established or reestablished a regional arsenic consortium made up of the stakeholders in arsenic that we have had a long relationship with, but we brought them back together for a day-long meeting, and we discussed what are the priorities now for arsenic and well water. And again, we found that bringing them together, everyone was just very excited. We saw the passion that these people have from USGS, New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services, Health and Human Services, for this issue. And I think one of the lessons I've learned is that, again, coming together, it brings people, gives them a source of power and helps those ideas flow. And what I found as a result is a number of these stakeholders have come to me and said, I have this idea. What do you want me to do next? You know, have I done a good enough job? I'm trying to get the movie out and trying to get it into various resource documents and out to the community. So that's really been exciting to have that additional networking occurring.
And that was slide 26.
Yep, thank you.
Sure.
And interestingly, too, we have now, I spoke a couple of times, I mentioned the New Hampshire Realtors Association. We invited a representative to this ARCNIC consortium as a result of a suggestion from a colleague at New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. They were not able to come, but we received an invitation to attend one of their meetings and talk about ARCNIC and the research that we're doing at Dartmouth. And I used that as an opportunity to bring my colleague from New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services with me. And he mentioned that he had not been able to get an invitation from them to participate in one of their meetings, to be able to talk to them a little bit more about requiring arsenic testing at home sales. So I was able to, I think, as a result of the kind of the more research and academic institution connection, bring him along. And now we're both being welcomed with open arms, and that's taking place on Earth Day, where we'll go and talk with them. So I'm hoping that'll open up some new connections and opportunities. And now I'm advancing to slide 27. I guess I want to just mention again that I think bringing people together, especially around a common issue, helps empower people. You come up with more ideas, you come up with sort of, you feel like you have the support of the group to move forward and get more things accomplished. So the movie has really been a great catalyst, not only for helping to tell the community about why they need to test their well, but it's also been an opportunity to help us bring our stakeholders together and move forward with some of the arsenic agenda that we've identified. One of the things that we've realized, too, in convening these folks is that there's more to be done, especially in terms of once you test your well, then how do you get those results back to people in a way that makes sense? Exactly the question that came up on that Survey Monkey. I'm now on slide 27. How do I interpret these results? What is a safe level? So one of the things we've identified is the need to come up with a common report back letter that would be used by the state lab, by private labs, by Dartmouth, and then also the remediation companies run the gamut, we've realized, and it's very difficult for private well owners to know what kind of remediation they need. It depends on the arsenic speciation, if they have arsenic 3 or arsenic 5. It depends on the kind of water they have in their home, the number of folks living there. There are all kinds of issues. So we have some ideas to help people navigate those issues, one of them being an online tool, kind of a questionnaire. But there still are a lot of barriers that are things we need to solve and overcome in order to really get people to test their well and then remediate to remove arsenic. I'm going to the next slide, 28. So some of our future distribution mechanisms, we want to continue to get out into the community, hoping to have sort of a booth, informational booth at home shows. A lot of communities have market days in the summer, especially in high arsenic areas like the Concord region and Portsmouth, New Hampshire areas. And I'd like to show the movie again in the Concord area, possibly connected to some presentation on our Dartmouth research on arsenic in water and food. Again, continuing to follow up on some of the ideas that we've generated through the Northeast Regional Arsenic Consortium meeting. and approaching local health organizations whose membership includes private well owners. And one of the interesting things that we've realized is, in terms of engaging a community, private well owners, we're not sure. They are certainly a community, but they don't know they're necessarily a community. In other words, they don't necessarily have organizations that bring them together. They're more isolated. Every well is different. If you have zero arsenic, your neighbor might have 50. So not only are we dealing with barriers to translation, we're also dealing with how to make people feel that they are more of a community. So ultimately, I hope that we can get the movie out enough such that people are talking to one another and saying, hey, have you seen that movie and about arsenic and well water? And maybe eventually we'll even have one of those light bulb type jokes. How many experts does it take to get arsenic out of your well water? And maybe one of you guys out there can think of the punchline. I wasn't able to do that in the time that I had. But that's it. I just want to thank that list of folks who have been so instrumental and helpful with this process. And we're continuing to learn. And we are hoping to do a movie about, or planning to do a movie on mercury, which is the other metal that we study. And so a lot of the lessons we've learned from the arsenic movie will apply to that movie. And I think at this point I can answer questions. I'm on slide 29. I apologize for my lack of telling you where I am, but thank you very much.
Thank you, Lori. And stay strong for the questions. People were able to hear, but your voice is a little low, so
okay.
Keep up the good work. I'd like to first turn to the phone and remind people if they want to ask a question, you can unmute your phone by pressing *7, and then after you ask the question, please go back to *6 and mute again. So are there any questions from the phone? Okay, while people are getting their thoughts together, I have a couple questions I can take from online participants, and I'll go back to the phone. The first question is from Jerry Black at Black & Associates in Norman, Oklahoma, and he is asking about the source of the funding for the movie and also about the issue of what is a safe level for arsenic.
Hi, thank you. The source of the funding for the movie was through our Superfund Research Program grant, which comes from the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences as part of the overall Superfund Research Program. And in terms of what's a safe level, 10 parts per billion is considered, 10 or below is considered safe by the federal EPA, at least in terms of that's the requirement for public drinking supplies. There's no requirement, no testing requirement for private wells. So I think a safe level is based on 10 or below. I would, if it were my well, I would prefer to just have zero because our research is showing that small doses at chronic, you know, over long-term chronic exposure do have health impacts. But that is something that we want to talk more about, and one of our thoughts for the future is potentially bringing arsenic experts together through some kind of potentially national conference to talk about that exact question.
Okay, I'm going to go to the phone next, but before I do, I just want to say that I know one of your earlier slides gave the URL for the film. I saw the film through, I believe, this website. It is very professionally done. I encourage everyone to go look at it. Any questions from the phone? A little louder, Chuck.
Okay. I thank you, Lori, giving a very good coverage of your outreach program, and I think that you have a great program there with the different tiers of communicating with communities and getting the communities to work amongst themselves. I just wanted to go back to, I believe it's slide 7, where you gave the SRP definition for the communication and community engagement. And I was wondering if you have any more plans or any ideas for future work to sort of get to loop back to the researchers, information from the stakeholders, from the communities, as to you know, the types of I don't know what types of information they would be providing, but perhaps the types of wells they have, or the uses of their well water versus other sources of bottled water or what have you. But just sort of my question gets at, do you have any further plans for trying to loop back providing information to the researchers? I guess much in the same vein as that 10 parts per million for the public consumption, and that sort of driving some research, and you're talking about a future national workshop on trying to figure out get a better handle on the arsenic. That I guess is a good example of that feedback loop. But do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, yes, we had a lot of ideas come out of the Arsenic Consortium meeting that we held in February, and one of the current ways that we're doing that is one of our research projects on epidemiology and biomarkers, led by Margaret Karagas, is she is running a birth cohort, and she is collecting all kinds of data from pregnant moms on private wells. So that is a really valuable feedback loop, and we will go forward with generating additional methods. We have thought of using the internet again and websites as ways to possibly reach people, whether we might set up a Facebook page and see if we get feedback that way. We also are considering doing a questionnaire designed to think about some, start kind of at the beginning in terms of what do people understand about arsenic, and then kind of move on from there. So in terms of the questionnaire about what do they understand, we would start with the basics, try to do some of that survey work this summer, and then move forward to more specific questions regarding testing and some of the barriers to why people don't, if they don't test, or if they do test, why do they not move forward with remediation, that kind of thing. We also work closely with the USGS and the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services, and they are out in the field a lot measuring wells. And so we're looking forward to continuing those collaborations and finding ways to get that information more readily available. Some of it is protected information, but we want to use some visual representations too. We think mapping and graphic representations will help people understand if they see where arsenic is showing up in their community, that will be helpful. And I hope that answers your question.
Okay. I want to turn to some of the questions I've gotten online. First, I have a couple questions from L. Dean Carpenter from the Federal Environmental Technologists in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, asking, what is the source of the arsenic in the drinking water, and do commercial home filters for faucets screen out arsenic?
Well, here in New Hampshire, Maine, and most of New England, but New Hampshire and Maine have the highest incidences of arsenic. It's from the bedrock. So we happen to have the right combination of pH and dissolved oxygen that release the arsenic from the bedrock into the water. So that's the source, and so it's natural, and for the most part. And in terms of, remind me, Carol, of the second part of the question.
Do commercial home filters screen it out?
Thank you. No. As far as I know, they do not. They require, well, I mean, some commercial home filters, if they're designed to screen out arsenic, then the answer is yes. But I believe that your basic water purification system doesn't, like a Brita filter or something along those lines, does not. And again, what we're dealing with is the fact that there are different species of arsenic, arsenate and arsenite, so the type of system you use depends on the speciation of the arsenic in your water. So again, you, house to house, the variation on the amount of arsenic can go from 0 to 100 when you're right next door, and I think that may be the same case with the type of system you need. It also depends on the type of water you have, if it's soft water, what other minerals are present, and that kind of thing.
Okay, I'm going to do another couple from the internet. I'm going to combine two. I think you're giving people ideas. Sandy Mort in the North Carolina Division of Public Health is asking, how much did the film cost to produce? And Meredith Golden from Columbia University in the Palisades, New York, is asking about the possibility of making public service announcements from movie excerpts, and would it be possible, or is there a different approach for public service announcements?
Good questions. All in all, in terms of the cost, I would say that this was about $25,000. We didn't pay quite that much, but we were told we went over budget basically. So I would say about 25. And Meredith, that's a very good question about the PSAs. I don't see any reason why that couldn't happen. And what will help us answer that question, I think, is when we see the Teacher's Domain short version. They have adapted a 3-minute or so version from our 10-minute original, and that's not up yet on their site, so I'm anxious to see that once it's finished. And that will show us what they've done to get the messages through. And it's an interesting question. It may be that we can't get it all in like a 60-second PSA. Those usually are 15, 30, and 60 seconds. So whether we could get enough of the right info in such a short amount of time, I'd have to look at that carefully with other folks.
Okay, I want to go back to the phone again and see if there are any more questions on the line. Okay, hearing none, I have several more coming in from the internet. From Jennifer Shearer at Charleston, Southern University in Charleston, South Carolina, is asking about the health impacts, and I'm going to combine that with Adria Ventura of the Clean Water Fund in San Francisco, is asking about, isn't the safe level the MCLG and not necessarily what is legally allowed by the drinking water standard?
Okay, so health impacts, it can contribute to a variety of cancers, diabetes, and we're finding that it can compromise immune system response. So our research recently has focused on mouse studies with the influenza A, and found that their ability to, when drinking arsenic water, I'm not sure what the exact level was, but they were not able to, their immune system was not able to fight off the flu the way that a mouse that had not been drinking arsenic-contaminated water was, so that's a possible impact. And in terms of the safe level, the MCL, I believe that the 10 parts per billion is the current MCL. I may need to get clarification on that question. So feel free to contact me afterwards, and we can talk about that. So thank you.
Okay, I'll go one last time to the phone. Hearing nothing, I have one last question from the Internet. And there will be another opportunity at the end if you think of anything. But from Jerry Black and Black Associates Norman, Oklahoma, is asking whether the public was presented with several sources of treatment options and cost for solving the arsenic problem in drinking water.
No. The answer to that question is not in so many words. Basically, we, through the movie anyway, were informing them about the need to test the well. The movie gives them one example of a particular homeowner who wound up using a water treatment system that was a point-of-use system that just goes under the sink that they were able to buy at Sears. What the movie doesn't include is that that person, that family, did a huge amount of research prior to deciding on this system, and they figured out this system, with its very low cost, would take care of their problem in terms of arsenic removal. But as far as I know, at least here, we haven't done any kind of major presentation about what types of systems there are and what you might need. I think people test, and there is information available through the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. When you get a test, you're given a list of remediation companies, I believe, and they are really left to themselves to make these decisions, and they need to seek out help or information to help them. And that's, I think, where a big part of the problem is it becomes very confusing. And some people are able to navigate that, and others aren't. So that's an area we really do need to address.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Reardon. We are going to switch now to our second presenter, Dr. Radomir Schmidt. And Dr. Schmidt's presentation begins on page or slide 30. Engaging the Community, Pilot Scale MTBE Bioremediation Project in Glenville, California. Dr. Schmidt is a graduate of University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia, and he carried out PhD research on the molecular analysis of chitinase activity in the bacterium Aeromonas hydrophila in the lab of Dr. John Pemberton. After receiving his PhD in 2001, Dr. Schmidt came to University of California, Davis for postdoc research in Dr. Valley Stewart's lab using molecular and genetic techniques to study the nitrate sensing apparatus of E. coli. Since 2005, Dr. Schmidt has carried out soil microbiology research with Dr. Kate Scow and Dr. Karasmira Histrova in the Department of Land, Air, and Water Resources at UC Davis. The primary focus of his current research involves bioremediation of gasoline constituents, MTBE, and terbutyl alcohol, TBA. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Schmidt.
Thank you, Carol, and thank you, Justin, for inviting me to talk on this forum. So as Carol mentioned, I started off with a very lab in the lab, research career where I wasn't interacting with anybody outside of the lab very much. So since 2001 and since coming to the U.S., I've kind of been moving more out of the lab and interacting with people more. And it's kind of culminated in this project in Glenville, California, which really from the start was designed to involve the people in the community of Glenville as much as possible. And so I'll speak a little bit about the science of what we're trying to achieve from the scientific point of view, but I'll try to be as brief as possible about that and concentrate more on the community aspects of what we were doing. So on slide 31, our main question was, are bioreactors safe? And the sort of bioreactor that we were studying is a fluidized bed bioreactor, and these have been developed in Europe in the mid-1980s for nitrate removal from drinking water. Their application in the U.S. has been very limited because there is very limited information about biosafety and whether any potentially pathogenic bacteria could grow in these bioreactors and impact the quality of water produced. I'm aware of only two examples where such bioreactors were used for drinking water production in states. One was a denitrification bioreactor in Coyle, Oklahoma, that ran for about 4 years before it was shut down, and a perchlorate treating bioreactor in California that received a conditional certification for the production of drinking water in 2005. Moving on to slide 32. This is a schematic diagram of our bioreactor for the treatment of methyl terbutyl ether, MTBE, and also terbutyl alcohol, TBA. The bioreactor itself is filled with sand, and water flows from the bottom of the bioreactor up, and this fluidizes the sand particles. And the sand particles provide the perfect environment for bacteria to form biofilms, and because the whole system is fluid and the sand particles are moving, there's a lot of interaction between the bacteria and the water flowing through the bioreactor, so it's very efficient at treating contaminants. The water flows through there's a constant flow of water through the bioreactor, and it's to some extent independent of the input water, so you can vary the input, and some of the water recirculates to make up the amount of water so that there's a constant flow, which is important for the bioreactor function.
Vladimir, I'm getting a request for you to speak a little louder.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
And the bioreactors, these bioreactors are usually inoculated with sand from an established bioreactor that's already treating MTBE to make sure that the correct bacteria are already present and the startup is as short as possible. On slide 33, I'd like to bring you to Glenville, California, which is a very small community in the Kern County, north of Bakersfield. It's in the foothills at an elevation of a little bit over 3,000 feet, and an hour drive up a narrow winding road from the nearest freeway. And both of these were important for us because it occasionally snowed there in winter, and we were not able to get to Glenbolt for general maintenance and things like that on a few occasions. Our project started in December, so we definitely had impact from the weather. And this community has been around since the 1850s, and really the presence of MTBE in their drinking water supply has had a major impact on the community. On slide 34, there's a couple of excerpts from an article from 1998, which talks about some of the impacts of MTBE on the local residents. Everybody in town was on ground private wells. They were relying on private wells for their drinking water. So when these became contaminated, it was necessary for the state to provide fresh water brought in by a truck to the town. The MTBE levels were extremely high, and drinking water is a very important and sort of primary resource, and it's a very emotional subject for anybody who's not able to get good, safe, clean drinking water. And Glenville was kind of at the forefront of the public awareness of the MTBE problem in the United States. In a couple of years later, in 2000, there was a 60 Minutes documentary which featured Glenville again as the sort of poster child for MTBE contamination in groundwater. So they've had people coming in to both ask them what their thoughts and feelings were about MTBE and MTBE contamination. They've had people coming in with proposals on how to solve the problem, but because it's also such a small community, that none of these had ever amounted to anything, because they're kind of too small to spend a large amount of money to be able to clean up the problem. So on slide 35, I want to kind of spend a couple of slides focusing on the MTBE problem, what it is, and why it's so difficult to deal with. And as you probably know, MTBE had been used as a gasoline additive, and its main problem is that it is extremely water soluble. And so if there's a leaking underground storage tank, the MTBE plume usually spreads much faster and further than any other gasoline components that's leaking out. There's an estimated 10,000 sites impacted by MTBE in California, and really quite a lot of water is, drinking water is impacted by MTBE of the thinning PVB primary MCL. And the other problem with MTBE is that under anaerobic conditions, which exist in most aquifers, it breaks down extremely slowly and often doesn't break down all the way to all the way, but you end up with, often you end up with TBA, which is a breakdown component, which is more toxic than MTB, and so it's in some ways a worse problem. In slide 36, the Lawrence Livermore National Lab published a very nice, or depressing, depending on how you look at it, comparison of locations of drinking water wells and leaking underground storage tanks, and not surprisingly, both of those occur in population centers. So if you place those two maps on top of each other, you'll see that there's close proximity of leaking underground storage tanks to drinking water wells all throughout California. And many of those leaking tanks would have MTBE as one of the components involved in leaking into the groundwater. So moving on to slide 37. As I mentioned, Glenville was supplied by a private well water. They had an old gas station tank started leaking, and the leak was detected in the mid-90s. And MTB, TBA, and VTEX were found to contaminate a number of local private drinking water wells, and the residents have been without a local water supply since 1998. Slide 38 shows a recent map of the plume of MTBE with the location of the old gas station, which is near the center of the plume still. And as you can see, more than 10 years later, there's still an estimated 10,000 micrograms per liter of MTBE at the central part of the plume. As another problem with Glenville, in specifically, their aquifer is a fractured rock aquifer, which means that the movement of water within the aquifer is not easily predictable. And so, as you can see, there are those two arms that stretch out further, and you can have contaminated wells that are much farther than uncontaminated wells, and which wells are contaminated changes year by year as well. And also, as we saw in the wells that we were using during our project, the concentration of MTBE coming in or coming out of the well changed quite considerably over time. So what I've tried to demonstrate so far is that this is a complex problem with not a very easy solution, and we also had a very complex and diverse group of stakeholders involved. On slide 39, the list of all the people involved and what their primary concerns and questions might be. So obviously the Glenville residents are interested to getting clean, reliable source of water. The UC Davis Superfund, who were involved in setting up this project to begin with and bringing us into the community are very interested in bringing research out of the lab and into the real world. The ERI, the company that manufactures and runs these bioreactors, are interested in the end use of the water that they make, because in general the water is, has to be disposed of as sewage essentially, even though oftentimes the only problems with the water are the primary contaminants like MTBE. So if you remove them, presume, you know, it should be good water that can be used for downstream applications by people. We as scientists were interested in kind of the same thing, but more specifically in the one question of whether harmful bacteria pose any threat from these bioreactors. And the regulators who were, of course, involved from throughout the whole project are most interested in how they can provide safe drinking water for their constituents. So our project plan on slide 40 in centered around coming to the community, hold a meeting before we decided on anything concrete, to tell the residents what we could do, perhaps even more importantly, tell them what we couldn't do, what we had and or did not have money for, what the current state of technology was that we had, and set up a discussion where we would be able to listen to their concerns and their input on what they thought could be done in their community. And based on that, we came in and set up a pilot scale bioreactor. We're planning to run the bioreactor for about 6 months to determine the cleanup efficiency and final water quality. In the end, we managed to run it for a little bit longer, but not much, about 9 months. And throughout the period of running this bioreactor, we held further meetings to update residents and other stakeholders on our progress. And we were hoping, if the bioremediation was successful, to seek further funding to continue cleanup and hopefully put in a full-scale bioreactor that would be able to do a full-scale cleanup job on the aquifer. On slide 41 is one of the examples of the flyers we distributed with the help of a couple of locals throughout the community. We try to be as factual as possible and also inject a little bit of humor into the discussion to kind of not just have everything be super dry and boring that we as scientists are and engineers can be, can have problems with. We held meetings in the community to discuss the problem, discuss the technology, how we would monitor what is going on, and on slide 42, and to get the locals as involved as we could in the project, to tell them on slide 43 where exactly we would be. So this slide 43 is a map of the groundwater monitoring wells around the old gas station in Glenville. We had access to the wells in black. In green, the green dot is the location of the bioreactor itself. And as you can imagine, since these are private water wells, the people are, some of the residents are quite protective of their wells and protective of access to their properties. So we wanted to reassure them that we would be working kind of in the parking lot next to the gas station primarily and not spreading further in the field. Slide 44 is the, it shows the bioreactor itself in the shed behind the old gas station. And slide 45 is the summary of the community response that we found from our first meeting with them. As you can probably appreciate, since the locals have been exposed to information about MTB for a number of years, they were very well informed about MTB as a problem and an impact. They were very interested in learning about the bioreactor and about how the bacteria in the bioreactor deal with MTB based on their long-term problems with MTB. They were also understandably skeptical about the long-term prospects of real final solution to their problem, because they understood that, you know, MTB is not an easy problem to deal with. And importantly for us, they were very willing to work with us to make the project happen. They provided the facilities for the bioreactor, a place for the bioreactor to sit, electricity to run the bioreactor. They helped with organizing the meeting in Glenville, distributing flyers, helping with shipping samples to us and to labs for assessment. And in the latter part of the project, one of the locals was also involved in the actual operation and assisting with the operation and maintenance of the bioreactor, so we could save some money on getting a technician to come out there every week. He could come every other week, and the bioreactor was running smoothly. Also, the electrical supply in Glenville was not always functioning, so it was great to have somebody on site who could come in and check that if the electricity cut out and came back on, that the bioreactor was everything turned on back on and everything was running smoothly after any problem like that. So it was because of the remoteness of this of Glenville, it was really crucial for the project to run to have people in the community involved in the operation and in the project. So the next slide, slide 46, kind of a summary of the challenges that we found of running a project like this. The first one, and the probably most important one is clear communication. Make sure that the people in Glenville are always updated of any new developments. And really, we in hindsight, what we needed to do there was to have somebody dedicated as a contact person for Glenville residents, so they would communicate with them and also be available if people in Glenville had any questions or inquiries. I mean, we had, everybody was able to answer any questions, and we had contact with them on a regular basis, but it was kind of, because we were a diverse group of scientists and engineers, there wasn't really a central person who was responsible for the communication, and I think that someone like that is really important in a project like this. And we also needed to reemphasize that this was a pilot project that was not going to clean up the MTB spill by itself, that this was kind of the first step of the cleanup process, and we had to repeat that throughout the project to make sure that people understood that if we didn't get further funding, we were not going to be saving them from MTBE. As I mentioned, it was a challenge to run a bioreactor at a remote location with a somewhat unreliable electrical grid. And it was also challenging to run a complex demonstration project like this with a very limited budget. So to conclusions on the community side of things, on slide 47, this is really a summary of ideas, some of which we did and some of which we had done in hindsight. We were, as I mentioned a couple of times really now, we were a group of scientists and engineers, and it would have been really great to bring somebody with a more, bring a facilitator to optimize dialogue between us and the residents. I think we did overall reasonably well in talking to the people, but having somebody who's skilled in communication would have made everything even better and made the whole experience better for, you know, everybody involved. It's important to clarify all your expectations at the start of the project, which is a fairly obvious thing, but I think it needs emphasizing. And it's also important to have steps in place for the project end, to identify what will be the project endpoint, what you plan to achieve, and call it, you know, this is, we have achieved our objective and this is the endpoint of the project. Have a time scale for that as well. And to formally wrap up the project and have a community debriefing at the end of the project to communicate back to the people what has been achieved. And really one of the great and for us somewhat unexpected outcomes was that even though we did not secure more funding and we're not able to scale up to full-scale cleanup, a couple of the residents told me that they were glad that we were able to come in, and they were glad that they were able to participate in research on MTBE, and that it made them view the whole MTBE problem from a different perspective, instead of looking at it as, oh, we have this terrible problem in our community, to kind of think, oh, this is a terrible problem for California and the whole United States, and we're actually doing something. We're participating in helping to solve the problem in our own small little way. On slide 48, on the scientific conclusions, the bioreactor worked. It degraded MTBE and TBA below detection limit. One of the interesting findings we had was that with the fluctuation of MTBE coming into the bioreactor, if there was a low concentration of MTBE followed by high concentration, sometimes the efficiency of treatment was decreased. And so in situations like this, where there's a fractured aquifer with varying concentrations coming in, it may be necessary in these type of reactors to provide MTBE on a continuous basis to make sure that the community of MTBE-degrading bacteria in the bioreactor remains viable and effective in treatment. Perhaps more importantly, we did not detect any harmful bacteria in the bioreactor. We were monitoring a panel of potential groundwater pathogens, and it did not detect any of them in the bioreactor. And from that point of view, it was a positive first step toward determining if bioreactors can produce safe drinking water. Lastly, on slide 49, I would like to thank in particular Carol Knox and Candace Dominguez from Glenville, who were great to work with and helped us immensely in Glenville itself. Greg Isinghoff from the Central Valley Regional Water Quality Control Board is the face of the regulators for us. And, you know, it's really great to work with regulators who are, the main concern is helping the local residents get clean water, because he was very competent, knew all the rules and regulations that we needed to follow, and, you know, made sure that we were doing everything correctly according to him, but also went out of his way to make sure that all our questions were answered as quickly as possible, and that, you know, that the whole project could run as smoothly as possible. And I would also like to thank Dave and Joe from ERI, who put the bioreactor together in Glenville and let it run as long as they could. And with that, I will close and answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Smith. I would like to start with questions from the phone. Remember, if you would like to ask a question, you take your phone off mute by pressing *7, and then please state your name and organization and ask your question. And then please remute your phone. Are there any questions from the phone?
Hi, this is Lori Raritan. I had a question. I was just wondering, Radomir, in terms of your initial public meeting with the community, who you had there to help you with that presentation specifically? Was there anyone, and you may have said this, but who had expertise in risk communication, or it sounded like the community already knew a lot about the MTBE risks, but I'm just curious who the folks were at that meeting.
Yeah, thank you. We did not have an expert on in that area at the meeting. The main presenters were Krasimira Hristova, who is my boss here, and a representative from ERI, Dave Plenty, who talked about Dave talked about the bioreactor and how it kind of the technical part of that, and Krasi talked about the bacteria in the bioreactor and some of the as much of the risk as we could cover, but it would have, yeah, it would have been good to have somebody, you know, additional people to cover more of the risk assessment and that side of things.
Okay, I have several questions coming in online. Yeah, I have two questions related to slide 32, which is, I think, a picture of the bioreactor. Sheila Abraham at Ohio EPA in Twinsburg, Ohio, is asking the question, what is the size of the bioreactor? Is there an optimum size, or is it a function of contaminant levels and or flow rate? And on the same slide, Stephen DeMars from Pennsylvania DEP in Harrisburg is writing in, how much water can a bioreactor treat, and is there a relationship between the level of contamination and the amount of water that can be treated?
So with these particular bioreactors, ERI makes two models. The one we were using is the smaller one, which has a capacity of about 1,000 liters, and the larger full-scale bioreactor has a capacity of 5,500 liters or so. And sorry, I'm trying to look up all the details of this. Both the bioreactors have a fixed recycle flow rate, and their maximum loading is, for the smaller bioreactors, about 26 liters per minute, and for the larger bioreactors, 130 liters per minute. There is a relationship between the amount of contaminant and the treatment, but I believe that for the sort of concentrations that you see in the groundwater in the environment, normally the larger bioreactor, the full-scale bioreactor, is well set up to treating that. I don't know. I don't have the exact numbers, but if anybody is interested, please contact me, and I can get more detailed numbers to you after the presentation.
Okay, I'm going to take another online question, then I'll switch to the phone. We have a question from Jennifer Shearer at Charleston Southern University in Charleston, South Carolina. And Jennifer's question is, how likely is it that MTBE will contaminate water sources located near any gasoline storage tanks that leak? Or is it related to the geological conditions? Is it more of a geological phenomenon?
It is a geological phenomenon. It depends on in which direction the groundwater flows. So if there is a drinking water source downstream of the leaking tank, then it's more likely to be contaminated. If it's upstream, then it's unlikely to be contaminated. And I'm not familiar with the all the geological factors, so I don't know if that water flow can change or how likely it is to change in under usual conditions. So I would say it depends mainly on the features of the aquifer.
Okay. I'd like to go again to the phone. These are questions for Dr. Schmidt. If you'd like to ask a question, please unmute your phone by pressing *7. Ask your question and remute by pressing *6. Are there any questions from the phone at this time? Okay, hearing none, I have another question from coming in online. This is related to slide 38, and it is also from Sheila Abraham of Ohio EPA in Twinsburg, Ohio, and Sheila is asking whether vapor intrusion, contaminated groundwater moving into indoor air, whether that was identified as an issue in this community.
Not that I know of.
Okay. All right. I'll do another one from the from online, which is slide 43 is the slide of the Greenville Glenville groundwater monitoring wells. And this question comes from Meredith Golden at Columbia University in the Palisades, New York. And Meredith is asking about this slide of the monitoring wells and what type of modeling was used to determine the extent and direction of the plume, if you can address that.
I cannot. The modeling and sampling of all the monitoring wells is done by a private contractor, and I'm afraid I don't know what exactly they did for the modeling of the plume. But they take samples on a twice a year from all the wells, and there's a few wells that are outside of the area covered in the picture on that slide as well.
Okay. I have another question, and after I ask this question, I will go back to the phone to see if there are any more questions on the phone for Dr. Schmidt. This question relates to the wonky electrical grid. I think that's the first time I've heard wonky in a presentation. And it's from Jerry Black of Black & Associates in Norman, Oklahoma. And Jerry Black is asking, could alternate energy sources such as solar panels or wind be used to assist you with the wonky electrical grid problem? Did you consider that, or do you think it would have been a possibility?
We did not consider that. For a longer term running of the project, yes, I think that would have been a possibility. The bioreactor uses about one I thought I had the actual power usage here in front of me, but I don't have the units for that. So it doesn't use all that much power. It's basically running the pump that runs water from the well into the bioreactor is the main power usage. And it's not all that much. So yes, a solar panel would have been, probably would have been sufficient. The possible caveat to that was that the power went out a couple of times during storms, and so I don't know how that would have affected the use of a solar panels or something like that. That probably might need to be there probably would have had to be batteries to store power and then run things from batteries rather than just doing directly. But I'm sure that that's a easy technical problem to solve.
Okay. Are there any more questions on the phone? Unmute your line by pressing *7. Ask your question, state your name, organization. Remute your line by pressing *6. Are there any more questions for Dr. Schmidt on the phone?
Yes. This is Lori Reardon from Dartmouth Superfund Research Program. And I just wanted to ask, it sounds like from your description of the community that having you come in and testing the bioreactor and setting it up in a way kind of empowered the community in that it gave them an opportunity to feel like they were part of the process and that they had something to do to deal with the problem. And I'm asking if that was your impression. I'm just learning that with dealing with public health and risk, you want to inform them, but you also want to give them a way to feel that there's something they can do. So would you say that was the case? It sounded like it was kind of a very positive result. Thank you.
Yes. That's definitely the impression I got from a couple of the people that that came to all the meetings that we had. And one of those was Harold, who was actually practically involved in running up the bioreactor. But yeah, I did get a couple of comments that brought that up, that these people were empowered by participating in the research into MTB, and that it gave them something to do, gave them a part of in the struggle against this problem. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that is a really important and powerful component of having a project like this in a local community, is to, you know, it's important to have these discussions and get people's input on what they need and want, but it's perhaps even more important to get them actively engaged and get them thinking about, you know, how they are involved in the bigger picture of what is going on.
Okay, I have a couple more questions that have come in from online. One is from Beth Anderson at NIEHS, our sponsor, in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. And Beth is asking the question that, assuming that you have published on this technology, she's wondering if you've published it as a case study about working with the community. Also, do you think that this technology will be picked up commercially?
So the technology is already commercially available. ERI has about 30 bioreactors, mainly in California, but in a couple of other places around the United States. The kind of the main point of our study was to try and figure out if you can actually produce drinking water, if you have to dump the water that you produce in a sewer. Sorry, could you remind me of the first part of the question?
If you've published this, then are you going to publish it as a case study about working with the community? And the second part is, do you think the technology would be picked up?
We have submitted a manuscript for the scientific part of the study. We have not, we haven't really thought about publishing it as a case study of engaging the community, I guess. It's probably something that we should think about as well. And it has not, but our manuscript has not been accepted and hasn't been published yet.
Okay, we'll go to the phone again. Are there any questions on the phone for Dr. Schmidt? To unmute your line, please press star 7, state your name and organization, and remute by pressing star 6. Are there any more questions on the phone for Dr. Schmidt? Okay, I have one more question, which I probably can't do justice to, online for Dr. Schmidt. It is from Huang Lin in the DEP in Pennsylvania, in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And Huang Lin is asking about the material and the ceramic filter, I believe some technical information about the bioreactor itself. And I think this question is about porosity in meters per gram. Are these questions that you can answer easily or maybe get back to Huang Lin?
It might be easier to get back to. The medium in the bioreactor itself is sand, and it's a fine grain sand, fine river sand is kind of what I can say right now. But yeah, if they contact me, I may be able to answer more specific questions.
Okay. At this point, I'd like to open it up to any other questions, either for Dr. Schmidt or Ms. Reardon, and I will go to the phone again. Are there any questions on the line for Ms. Reardon? Well, I have several that have come in actually for Ms. Reardon or on that subject, some of which are comments, some of which are questions, and some of which are linked. There are several questions related to the toxicity of arsenic and to safe levels. I will read these as questions and comments, and some of which I think could really be the subject of an entire seminar in itself. But I'll start with a comment by Adria Ventura of the Clean Water Fund in San Francisco. Adria writes, I am somewhat concerned that the message going out that an MCL or drinking water standard is the, quote, safe, unquote, level. MCLs are based on safety as well as technical feasibility and cost. Consequently, it doesn't always correspond to the maximum contaminant level MCLG goal, which is the safe level based on current science. This question has a lot to do with a comment received from Suad Hakim at DTSC in Cypress, California, who writes, EPA has set the arsenic standard for drinking water at 0.01 parts per million, 10 parts per billion, to protect consumers served by public drinking water system from the effects of long-term chronic exposure to arsenic. And then a third question on this same issue of the safe levels of arsenic and what is safe and how that should be communicated is a question from Huang Lin in the DEP in Pennsylvania, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Arsenic contamination of drinking water in the USA is about one quarter higher than 10 parts per billion. Is there any disease cluster caused by high arsenic contaminated drinking water in a community in the USA? So, Ms. Reardon, I don't know if you want to comment on the issue of regulatory level versus a no effect level or a level that would be generally considered as safe, and how that complex issue gets communicated to a community. Did we lose Lori? Hearing no answer, I'm wondering
Hello?
If we... Yes.
Oh, I screwed up and muted it the wrong way around.
Okay.
Sorry. I am saying that I think this warrants more discussion. I'd be happy to talk with folks afterwards, and I might need to defer to some other researchers in our program for some additional information, but I do think that it's hitting the nail on the head. I think that this is a conversation that needs to happen, and I think it would be well worth trying to bring people together in a formalized way to discuss this, because it is an issue. It's an issue that we're asking that question, and that was part of the question that we wanted to put out with the movie. What is a safe level? And, you know, if you watch the movie, Josh Hamilton from our program, who's been looking at this issue for many years, says, you know, there is no safe level in his opinion. So I hope I'm understanding those comments and questions properly. And in terms of the question about disease clusters, I don't know the answer to that. So, again, I would have to follow up later and try to help Huang Lin identify the answer. That might be something that Margaret Karagas from our program might know where to find that information, and some of the USGS folks we work with might as well.
Great. Okay, I have one last online question before I do that. I would like to close out phone questions. Are there any final phone questions for either presenter? Again, to unmute your line, it's *7. Okay, hearing none, I'm going to we have one last question for Ms. Radner from, no, Ms. Reardon. And it is from Jerry Black of Black and Associates in Norman, Oklahoma. We gave you, you've had the sticky toxicology question, now you get the risk management question. Dr. Black writes, or Mr. Black writes, it seems that testing is fine, but if you have an arsenic problem with drinking water without a solution, that is a situation that can cause undue emotional stress. And help with solution options serves the public interest. So how does or how do you work with the governmental side to help with the public to help come up with solutions for when a well tests high?
Right. That is something that I was referring to earlier when I was mentioning this arsenic consortium and the work that we're going to do with our colleagues at our state Department of Environmental Services and the USGS and EPA Region 1 as warranted to move forward on figuring out ways to help them deal with these options, because I think this is a process for us, and it may seem as if we're jumping the gun, saying test, 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 but then not having a really solidified program to help them take that next step. And I totally agree with that, but we have to move through the process to get us to that point. So I think we are able to help these other agencies move forward, I'm hoping, with this agenda through our time and resources that we can provide. And we'll just keep trying to come up with appropriate ways to reach the community. And as I mentioned, through websites, through an online questionnaire, through more. We also would like to do a remediation company training, partnering with the National Groundwater Association to make sure that what remediation companies are offering is A, certified, and B, is the same information across the board, because that is not happening at all right now. And so I hope that answers the question. I'm happy to talk with Mr. Blackmore afterwards if that would be appropriate.
Okay, great. Before we close out, I want to make sure that everyone is aware of the links page with more information and our online feedback form, which I should have mentioned a little earlier again. On the link page, there are resources directly applicable to today's topic, and these will stay on that page with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. And again, these will be placed in an archive. We do look forward to you filling out the feedback form. It really helps us, and we are looking forward to your comments. You can contact either presenter by email if you have any additional questions. And if we did actually get to all the questions that I received online. I would like to thank both our presenters very much, Ms. Reardon, and please, everyone, go look at that presentation. It's online, the 10-minute arsenic video. It's great. And Dr. Schmidt, thank you so much, and thank you for preparing and sharing your information with us today. This concludes today's presentation, and we thank you so much for your participation.